is The Guardian.
I'm Bridie Jabbour, coming to you from Gadigal land, and this is Full Story, Newsroom Edition. When the leaves on the trees in Parliament House's forecourt start to change, it can only mean one thing. Budget lockup is almost upon us. And for next week's federal budget, Treasurer Jim Chalmers faces a unique set of economic and social challenges.
It would not be wise when people are doing it tough and when the economy is soft for us to slash and burn in this budget.
And he also needs to demonstrate that his government's economic management is stronger than the opposition's.
The budget is in much better nick than the budget that we inherited almost precisely 2 years ago.
Today, Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Deputy Editor Patrick Keneally on how the government tries to sell the budget. It's Friday, the 10th of May.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Good morning, Lenore.
Morning, Bridie.
Good morning, Patrick.
Morning.
Next Tuesday is the Albanese government's third and possibly final budget before an election. There's a whole lot of rhetoric and manoeuvring around the budget, which we will get into. But first of all, let's talk about what the lockup actually is.
It is a sort of an Australian-specific tradition. I don't think they do it in other places, certainly not in the UK, where the media is locked up, as in has no access to electronic communications at all, for several hours before the Treasurer gets to his feet at 7:30 to deliver the budget speech. The ostensible reason is so that market-sensitive information can be digested, and then when the Treasurer gets up, the markets have closed. I think a likely reason is that the government of the day wants us to have time to read what is a lot of material and think about it and digest it before we immediately start reporting it. And also over time, it has been sort of more constrained in order to more manage the message. So once upon a time, because I have been doing these things for many, many years, we could access officials from other parties or interest groups in the lockup. You can't do that now. In fact, I think the press gallery is locked up in their own individual rooms, and we have a sort of secure link to a lockup in Sydney where we're editing the budget coverage. You basically can't get anybody else's views or ideas or thoughts on what's in the budget before you start reporting on it. You just have your own assessment and reading of it.
But before the lockup, there are quite a few things that we already know is going to be in the budget, because the government has a narrative they're working to get out beforehand, don't they?
Yeah, the government is continually in the lead up to the budget, either making announcements publicly, or there's a whole series of either leaks or drops out to media.
Mostly drops.
Mostly drops, yeah.
Many more drops than leaks.
I think they, you know, sometimes like to think they're leaks, but they're really just drops, which are, you know, what journalists call pretty much information that's just given from the government to a journalist, a favoured journalist often. And, you know, sometimes it might go to Channel 9, sometimes it might go to Sydney Morning Herald, sometimes it might come to us. But they do it in a way that they think they will get the best possible publicity for their budget. and, you know, different policies and how they all appear to the public. So there's a whole lot of kind of dark arts going on in there in media units within the Treasurer's office and Prime Minister's office thinking, you know, the pre-sell of the budget, how can we get all these pre-announcements out in a way that's going to set the narrative for us and set us up for success in the budget?
Yeah, and like Pat says, that is partly about making sure they get maximum publicity for each bit of the budget, but it's also about corralling the message. So they know that on the night we're going to concentrate most on the bits we didn't know about, so they eke out some bits of it early so that then on the night the bits that are new are the bits that they really want the media to focus on the most. So it's sort of a message controlling thing. And also, you know, they're also thinking about the phrases and the terminology that they can use to try to influence the messaging on the night, influence those headlines, you know. So a killer line like, you know, Paul Keating's "This is the one that brings home the bacon," or Peter Costello's one in 2002 when he wanted to focus on his baby bonus and he said, you know, "Have one for mum, one for dad and one for the country." Like, they're thinking all the time about how they can corral us to a point where the picture we paint around the budget is the one that they want us to paint.
But sometimes it doesn't go so well. Joe Hockey's "The End of the Age of Entitlement" was his kind of budget line, and I think that went down like a lead balloon with most people.
Yeah, that was the 2014 budget, and I think in that way, though, the pre-messaging almost worked too well in the first instance, in that lots of media picked up on what the government was saying, which was that, you know, this was the fiscal medicine that Australia needed, whatever. But the measures in the budget were so harsh and so difficult to swallow for most Australians that over time a lot of it came unstuck, came undone. So, you know, I think in that was an instance of in most of the media, not Guardian, but most of the media, they got the message they wanted, but the budget itself was so poorly constructed that it came undone over time.
So what do we know is already in this budget?
So I think the centrepiece of the budget and the one that the government has really been keen to talk up is cost of living relief. Like, that's the main message they're trying to get out of it. So they're talking about things like the tax cuts, changes to stage three, which would deliver tax cuts to more Australians.
There was also the changes in, we already know that they're going to change the indexation rate for HECS and help debt, which was, you know, becoming a really sore point for students. We know defence spending is going to be increased and rejigged. I think we also know a bit about what won't be there. So we know there won't be, or it seems very unlikely that there'll be further changes to job seeker levels. And, you know, I think sometimes we too easily accept that something is too expensive. But budgets are about choices, right? And the government is making a choice, or we think they're making a choice, to not increase JobSeeker, even though it is below the poverty line in a cost of living crisis. But there have been sort of hints that maybe there would be some adjustment to other allowances like rent assistance, and that could be for both JobSeekers and youth allowance. And that would be, that would give the government something to say when asked, what are you doing for the people who are struggling at the most?
I think the other pieces that we know about the budget so far is Jim Chalmers being keen to say that this will not be an inflationary budget. It won't add to inflationary pressures, which is part of the reason why they're saying things like, you know, we just can't add more to the JobSeeker payment at the moment, why they're, you know, keen to kind of dampen down expectations at the moment of spending. But there's also a whole series of other smaller measures which were inside the budget. And I say small, but they're still often worth billions of dollars. Like, for example, the Future Made in Australia package, which is a whole range of spending measures from the government, including things like quantum computing, minerals research and exploration. So there's a range of measures that have been dropped to the media so far.
But I think Pat's right that the sort of central point of analysis is going to be whether the budget adds to aggregate demand, whether it is or is not inflationary. Jim Chalmers insists he can put more money into people's pockets and not add to upward pressure on inflation. The new RBA governor, Michelle Bullock, says she doesn't think government spending is adding to inflation yet, but this is going to be what's scrutinised. And I think it's going to be particularly scrutinised because the coalition's spent decades claiming that Labor can't, you know, manage the economy, and also, you know, really expounding this idea that a budget surplus now and forecast into the future is the measure of a good treasurer, is the be-all and end-all. And I feel like we would be better served by slightly more sophisticated analysis than that.
I think that's also why Jim Chalmers and others within the government see this as really critical, that they must come out with either a surplus or a very balanced budget, because they see it as a generational opportunity to change the narrative away from what happened in the GFC, where they were attacked for, you know, by Tony Abbott quite effectively for his so-called debt and deficit disaster. And they see this as Labor has got this, you know, one shot in government now to completely change that narrative and flip it, and Labor become, you know, perhaps once again, if you look at the Hawke Keating years, once again, the party of better economic managers. And they see this as like really critical to the like long-term survival and future of the Labor Party.
But so much of that surplus argument is BS, right? Like, it really is nonsense. And that, you know, so much of the budget and the budget situation is outside of a particular government's control. I mean, Peter Costello, yep, he ran surpluses for decades and paid off the Commonwealth government's debt, in part through spending cuts, yes, but mostly because he had massive, massive soaring commodity prices and more revenue coming in than he knew what to do with. Some budgets, he had so much money that he just gave pensioners $500 for the hell of it and said it was an energy bonus or some such. Yep, he set up the Future Fund. That was a good idea. But they could have done a lot more to sort of future-proof the Australian economy then. And then, you know, Wayne Swan and Josh Frydenberg, they both ran deficits because they each faced a huge economic shock, the GFC and the pandemic. You know, that was the right time for government spending. They did the right thing. And Chalmers is now benefiting from higher commodity prices, international factors, which means revenue estimates are going up and they're higher than forecast. And I think he probably will deliver a second surplus on Tuesday. And I think that's the right thing for him to do. But I just, I feel the idea of a surplus as being the be-all and end-all measure of a treasurer's competence or incompetence is, you know, I don't think we should all swallow it.
Craig Emerson wrote an interesting piece to the AFR a while back, looking at the last 50 years of budgets and how Labor and the coalition compared. And really, when you look at it, there's actually very little in it. Like, he talked about the overall tax take as a percentage of GDP. Over the last 50 years, Labor's been at 21.1% of GDP on average, while the coalition's 21.9%. So the coalition's been higher taxing overall, but really 0.8%. There's not much in it. When you look at other measures, like average spending as a percentage of GDP, the coalition's on 24.5% and Labor's, you know, basically similar, within 0.5% of the coalition. So this narrative has developed, which doesn't actually relate very closely
to reality.
To reality, exactly.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I do believe and accept that if governments have a revenue windfalls, if the economic times are good, you know, they should put the budget into surplus and they should start paying down debt. Like, that is the right thing to do. But I really don't buy the argument that balanced budgets in and of themselves, you know, lead to a better society, that, you know, all boats rise or whatever they say. I mean, we had decades and decades of incredible economic growth in Australia, those years when governments had money to burn, and we still had rising inequality and really entrenched inequality at the end of it. I mean, was that really the best way to spend our money? And, you know, during that same period, or sort of after the GFC, other governments went to sort of extreme austerity measures in order to rebalance their budgets. And that, A, it was bad for their economies. It hollowed out the middle class and there weren't any consumers to keep their economy going. And B, it was disastrous for their political systems. That level of inequality and that level of hardship led to the polarisation of politics and repercussions that are sort of still reverberating. So, you know, I just think the arguments need to be more nuanced. We need to kind of pull apart the ideology that's prevailed for a really long time and think about it a bit.
Which I think is what we're going to be doing in lockup on Tuesday.
Along with a lot of jelly snakes.
And the media has a role to play in that narrative, don't they? So how does the media choose what to cover and how to cover the budget?
I think different parts of the media look at a budget through different prisms. So the News Corp, particularly the Australian, and probably the Fin Review as well, have a pretty dry economic view of things that colours how they report about something like Future Made in Australia. They see it as interventionist industry policy, not a good thing, picking winners, that perhaps Australia would be better off just continuing to buy manufactured goods from countries where labour market costs are lower. The government, as Pat said, sees it as a strategic and an economic imperative, and they're not at all ashamed or apologetic about it being more interventionist, although they say the aim is to attract private capital in a global race for private capital for the energy transition in particular. So I guess in some ways we look at a budget through a more progressive lens. We're going to report more from the perspective of inequality and fairness. So there's a legitimate sort of different way of looking at things. I think there's also a responsibility to sort of dig behind the narratives, the he said, she said narratives of the parties, which can sort of really dumb things down.
So as we touched on before, the lockup in Australia is very unique. What do they do in other countries when it comes to the budget?
Yeah, it is a bit of a strange process in Australia that's developed over decades. But Australia's not the only one to have its own little weird quirks. Like in the UK, for example, they have this red leather box that the budget papers have to sit in. The Chancellor of the Exchequer stands outside, I think it's number 11 Downing Street where she lives, and holds up the red box and shows it around to the media, and they all take photographs of it before. But that's not the only weird thing. There was another great one. Apparently, it's the only speech throughout the year in which the speaker can drink alcohol while speaking. Mm. So apparently, Gordon Brown, of course, drank mineral water while he was there, but others have drunk things like gin and tonic, Jeffrey Howe, brandy and water, Benjamin Disraeli. And Gladstone liked to drink sherry with a beaten egg, which...
it's gross.
That's disgusting.
It's just completely gross.
I never understand what's relaxing about drinking on the job. Next, trains, buses and a difficult forecast.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
And now it's time for what we can't get out of our heads. What was it for you this week, Patrick?
So the federal government is not the only one to issue a budget around this time of year. The Victorian government's just released their budget in which they again kick the can down the road on building a rail link to Melbourne Airport, partly because there's been this ongoing fight between the Victorian state government and the Melbourne Airport Corporation over whether the train station should be above ground or below ground, and the airport wants it below ground, which would cost much more money. So instead, the Victorian Treasurer said, oh, well, if you don't like this proposal, we'll just build a rail line to Avalon Airport, which is like three times as far and will cost way more money. It's just a very funny tactic, I think. And I think Melbourneites would be pretty annoyed if the wrong airport got a rail link before, you know, the one that's actually much closer to the city. Every time I take a flight to Melbourne and you have to get on Skybus and go into the city, I think, God, this is like Australia's most popular city and it's a joke. Anyway.
I disagree. We've had this argument.
I know you like the rail. I know you like the Skybus, but...
What is wrong with the Skybus?
Trains are just so much more efficient. They don't get caught in traffic.
It's fine. You get on the Skybus. It dumps you in the middle of the city. I see no problem with the Skybus.
Readers are welcome to send in letters of support of the Skybus. Listeners.
I know my view is a minority.
Moving on from the Skybus. Lenore, what can't you get out of your head?
Something altogether more depressing. Guardian in the UK, or Guardian around the world, actually asked 380 of the world's leading climate scientists what they felt about the future. The resulting story is, I've got to say, very hard to read. 77% of those 380 top climate scientists think global temperatures will reach at least 2.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, which is a disaster. It's a complete disaster. Almost half think it'll be more than 3 degrees Celsius, and only 6% of them think that the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit, which is what's in the Paris Agreement, will be achieved. And they describe how terrified they are. And it's really not easy reading, but I think it's essential reading.
Yes, I had to brace myself before I clicked on that headline.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me this week, Lenore.
Thanks, Bridie.
Thank you, Patrick.
Pleasure.
That's it for today. This episode was produced by Camilla Hannan and Joe Koenig. The executive producer is Miles Martignoni. If you enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe to Full Story, where you can also leave us a rating and review. I'm Bridie Jabbour, and we'll be back with a new episode of Full Story on Monday.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.